听力课堂，听 class.com。
Sample test 3, part 1. A. The United States has been called a nation of immigrants. Indeed, aside from the American Indians, all Americans are immigrants or the descendants of immigrants.All have come from other places within the last 400 years. Americans came from different parts of the earth and for different reasons. Some came to escape persecution, religious or political, others to find a better life for themselves and their children. Still others were looking for adventure or for wealth. As for the blacks, they were forcibly brought here as slaves. Immigrants usually came in waves.The early settlers came mainly in the 17th and 18th centuries, mostly from the British Isles. In the middle decades of the 19th century, a much larger wave of immigrants arrived, chiefly from Ireland and Germany. But the really huge wave reached the United States between 1880 and 1920. Over 23 million people came during that period, more than twice as many as had come in all the years before.Unlike their predecessors, who were mostly from northwestern Europe, the later arrivals were mainly from eastern and southern Europe and from various parts of Asia. This meant that they were quite different from the old-time Americans in language, appearance, customs, attitudes, and in other respects. All these immigrants, as well as the later ones, had to adjust to the unfamiliar conditions they found in the new place, and all had to work very hard to survive.Consequently, newcomers tended to stay together, forming close-knit communities and clinging to their old customs and their language. They also organized mutual aid societies to help one another in the new environment.
B. 1. This music of yours is not actually bothering my studying, but I'm trying to sleep now.
2.With the new laws and social awareness, we'll get pollution under control.
3. Jamie doesn't want to live in the dormitory next year. She needs more privacy.
4. Professor Lawrence is going to retire, but she is still going to lead a graduate seminar each semester.
5. I can't lend you my bicycle because it's already on loan to someone.
6. If the weather doesn't get any better, we may have to scrap our plan for this afternoon's picnic.
7. I'm not going to need any surgery after all. I can start working out again soon.
8. Jane was furious that I lost her notes, but I let her cool off before I talked to her.
9. I spent over an hour waiting for Dr. Smith to see me. Something must have come up.
10. I'm not able to pick you up to the concert. What about just getting together there?
Part 2. Now perhaps I should go on to some of the solutions that we should be looking at to stop this environmental catastrophe. There are short-term solutions and there are long-term solutions. In the short term, we need to make immediate cuts to the emissions that are coming from our power stations and cars. In the long term, we need to change the way society is thinking. Many people have heard of the 30% Club.This is a group of 22 nations which have agreed to cut their sulfur emissions by 30% on 1980 levels by the end of the century. Britain hasn't yet joined the 30% Club. Some of the other countries that have are Sweden, Norway, Canada, Germany, the Netherlands, even Russia has joined the 30% Club. This is only the first step on the road to effective sulfur emission control.And what we really want to see is reductions of between 60 and 90% over the next 10 years or so. And looking to the longer term, we shouldn't just rely on solutions that involve a technological fix. We shouldn't just clean up power station chimneys and car exhausts. What we need to do is change the way society thinks and reacts. The first thing that needs to be done is we need to use less energy. One way of using less energy is to increase recycling, and so recycling schemes and reuse of materials should be encouraged throughout Europe and North America. Secondly, we have to change our transport system. We have to look for a more efficient transport system which relies less on individuals' use of cars and more on a good public transport network. We must act now.
Part 3. Passage 1. You ask me to explain to you how I find out what is happening. Well, news can be something the authorities want you to know, or something they would rather keep secret. An announcement of a government's success, a denial of a failure, or a secret scandal that nobody really wants you to talk about. If the authorities want to tell the world some good news, they issue statements, communique, and call a press conference. Or politicians make speeches. Local newspapers, radio, and television help to alert foreign correspondents to what is going on. And by making contacts with local officials, journalists can ask for more information or explanations to help them write their stories. Unless the correspondent is an eyewitness, it's rare to trust any single source. Officials have a policy to defend. Opposition politicians want to attack it. Rumor and gossip can also confuse the situation. So you have to check information as much as possible, using common sense and experience as final checks to help establish just what's likely to be the truth, or close to it.
Passage 2. Andrew Warhol was born in 1928 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He studied at the Carnegie Institute of Technology. By 1950, Andy Warhol, as he now calls himself, moved to New York City and pursued a successful career as a commercial designer and illustrator. In the 1960s, Warhol became one of the leaders of the pop art movement. Taking its name from popular, this art used images in popular culture for subject matter. Probably one of Warhol's most famous images is called Campbell's Soup Can, a picture of a brand of a soup popular in the U.S. Other famous works are green Coca-Cola bottles and a three-dimensional Brillo box, which looks exactly like the box of soap pads sold in the supermarket. Now, Warhol also wanted to simplify the process of making art, so he silk-screened photographs onto painted canvas. He created very striking, brightly colored portraits of celebrities. The most famous are of Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor, and Elvis Presley. To make his art look even more mechanical, he would repeat many images of the same thing on the canvas, sometimes just changing the color or a few little details. He even named the place where he produced his art the factory. And Warhol was also a filmmaker and a publisher. His magazine, called Interview, was filled with articles and gossip about celebrities. With his trademark bushy white hair and his association with celebrities, this man who seemed somewhat shy was always in the public eye. It seems that the more fun he made of art and fame, the more famous Andy Warhol became. He died in 1987 and is the subject of the largest museum devoted to a single artist, the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, his hometown.
Passage 3. Accustomed though we are to speaking of the films made before 1927 as silent, the film has never been, in the full sense of the word, silent. From the very beginning, music was regarded as an indispensable accompaniment. When the Lumiere films were shown at the first public film exhibition in the United States in February 1896, they were accompanied by piano improvisations on popular tunes. At first, the music played bore no special relationship to the films. An accompaniment of any kind was sufficient. Within a very short time, however, the incongruity of playing lively music to a solemn film became apparent, and film pianists began to take some care in matching their pieces to the mood of the film. As movie theaters grew in number and importance, a violinist and perhaps a cellist would be added to the pianist in certain cases, and in the larger movie theaters, small orchestras were formed. For a number of years, the selection of music for each film program rested entirely in the hands of the conductor or leader of the orchestra. And very often, the principal qualification for holding such a position was not skill or taste, so much as the ownership of a large personal library of musical pieces. Since the conductor seldom saw the films until the night before they were to be shown, the musical arrangement was normally improvised in the greatest hurry. To help meet this difficulty, film distributing companies started the practice of publishing suggestions for musical accompaniments. In 1909, for example, the Edison Company began issuing with their films such indications of mood as pleasant, sad, lively. The suggestions became more explicit, and so emerged the musical cue sheet containing indications of mood, the titles of suitable pieces of music, and precise directions to show where one piece led into the next. Certain films had music especially composed for them. The most famous of these early special scores was that composed and arranged for D.W. Griffith's film, Birth of a Nation, which was released in 1915.
Part 4. The 1950s and 1960s were years of great struggle for black Americans. Although slavery had been abolished in 1863, segregation in the 1950s, the separate and unequal treatment of blacks by whites, was still the custom in the northern part of the United States. In the southern states, it was the law. As an example, suppose you are a black citizen in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1954. A simple bus ride into town could be very frustrating. When the bus stopped for you, you paid the driver in the front of the bus. However, as a black person, you were not allowed to sit in the front. The front was for whites only. So after paying the driver, you had to get off the bus, walk to the back, enter at the rear door, and sit down in the back. What happened if the front of the bus was full and more white passengers got on? Well, you had to give up your seat in the back and ride standing. That was the law. On Thursday, December 1st, 1955, something important happened. On that day, Mrs. Rosa Parks, a middle-aged black woman, refused to give up her seat to a white man. The bus driver called the police, and she was arrested. This one small event helped change the direction of American history. It also marked the beginning of the career of the most famous black American leader, Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was a young minister in a black church in Montgomery. When he heard about Mrs. Parks' arrest, he, along with other black leaders in the city, decided to protest it. They organized a boycott of the buses for one day. That is, every black person in Montgomery was asked to stay off the buses for one full day. The boycott was a complete success. Because about 70% of the bus company's customers were black, the buses drove almost empty all day long. Later that day, black leaders decided to continue the boycott until the company promised black riders better treatment. As the boycott went on with Dr. King as its leader, the white people of Montgomery became more and more upset and angry. Dr. King was put in jail and beaten, and his house was bombed. But throughout all this, Martin Luther King told his people to meet violence with nonviolence and to meet hate with love. Because of his powerful message of nonviolence, no one was killed during the entire year of boycott. Finally, in 1965, the United States Supreme Court said it was illegal to segregate blacks and whites on buses, trains, or planes. Martin Luther King had taught his people a new way to win their rights. After the bus boycott, the use of nonviolent protest against segregation became popular throughout the South. Dr. King led many peaceful marches against segregation in restaurants, movie theaters, and other public places. On August 28, 1963, the biggest march of all was held. More than 1 million people from all parts of the country, black and white, young and old, marched on Washington, D.C. They wanted Congress to pass a national law against segregation and discrimination. 2 days after Dr. King gave his famous speech, one of his goals was achieved. the Civil Rights Act of 1964 became a new law that made it illegal to segregate blacks or other minorities or discriminate against them. In the same year, Martin Luther King also received the Nobel Peace Prize. His work was far from finished, however. He continued to fight for civil rights not only in the South, but also in northern cities like Chicago and Detroit, which had large numbers of unemployed black workers. His message was still one of nonviolence, although some young black leaders no longer accepted it as a way to win equality. In 1968, violent riots broke out in New York, Detroit, and Los Angeles, poisoning the air of the country with hatred and violence. The horrible climax came on April 4, 1968, when Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death by a white man. Thanks to Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement, black Americans and other minorities have won many rights in the last 30 years. Today, no shop owner can legally refuse to accept a customer because of race. Public facilities must be made available to all people. Schools can no longer be for white children only. Segregation has been made illegal. But have prejudice and discrimination completely disappeared from our society? Not at all. The struggle against them continues.
Sample Test 4, Part 1. A. It's generally believed that leaders are often thought to be people with unusual personal ability. However, decades of research have failed to produce consistent evidence that there is any category of natural leaders. It seems that there is no set of personal qualities that all leaders have in common. Rather, virtually any person may be recognized as a leader if the person has qualities that meet the needs of that particular group. Furthermore, although it is commonly supposed that social groups have a single leader, research suggests that there are typically two different leadership roles that are held by different individuals. Instrumental leadership is leadership that emphasizes the completion of tasks by a social group. Group members look to instrumental leaders to get things done. Expressive leadership, on the other hand, is leadership that emphasizes the collective well-being of a social group's members. Expressive leaders are less concerned with the overall goals of the group than with providing emotional support to group members and attempting to minimize tension and conflict among them. Group members expect expressive leaders to maintain stable relationships within the group and provide support to individual members. Instrumental leaders are likely to have a rather secondary relationship to other group members. They may discipline group members who inhibit attainment of the group's goals. Expressive leaders cultivate a more personal or primary relationship to others in the group. They offer sympathy when someone experiences difficulties or is subjected to discipline, are quick to lighten a serious moment with humor, and try to resolve issues that threaten to divide the group. So expressive leaders generally receive more personal affection from group members. Instrumental leaders, if they are successful in promoting group goals, may enjoy a more distant respect.
B. 1. After meeting with several failures, Walter is not unsuccessful with his new business.
2. At the meeting, the board chairman of the car company outlined a development strategy for the next decade.
3. Since Professor Smith cannot come on Friday, the quiz will be postponed until next week's class.
4. I'm having trouble fitting into my jeans. It looks like I'll have to cut down what I eat.
5. Lisa is out of the office again, another business meeting. She will be flying to Paris tomorrow.
6. We could take the train, but a direct flight will be a lot less complicated.
7. If you can't do better in this course, I'm afraid you will have to drop it.
8. Excuse me, do you have any apartments available for under $500 a month?
9. Professor Sinclair says that he will give us 1 week extension on our economic papers.
turn. Bill gave a diamond ring to Linda. It must have cost him an arm and a leg.
Part 2. Despite widespread medical opinion that alcoholic beverages may prevent heart disease, a leading medical expert is advising, don't start drinking just yet. Anybody who's ever worked in a hospital sees the hospital as full of patients that have alcohol-related disease, but the hospital is not full of patients that have diseases related to cholesterol and blood pressure-lowering medicines. In an editorial in the current New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Goldberg of Columbia University said it is time to see whether alcohol actually prevents heart disease. Such a study would give alcoholic beverages to one group of heart disease patients and not to another, and see which does better. In the latest study, which followed a group of men over a 12-year period, researchers found that those who drank three or more drinks per week reduced their risk of heart attack by 35% compared to abstainers. The lead author, physician Kenneth McConnell of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, insists his study is different from the rest. For one thing, other studies have not looked at drinking patterns. Dr. McConnell says his findings also appear to settle which alcoholic beverages are most heart healthy. Beer and spirits, beer and liquor, were most strongly associated with reduced risk.
Part 3. Passage 1. By the mid-19th century, the term icebox had entered the American language, but ice was still only beginning to affect the diet of ordinary citizens in the United States. The ice trade grew with the growth of cities. Ice was used in hotels, taverns, and hospitals, and by some forward-looking city dealers in fresh meat, fresh fish, and butter. After the Civil War, as ice was used to refrigerate freight cars, it also came into household use. Even before 1880, half of the ice sold in New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, and one-third of that sold in Boston and Chicago, went to families for their own use. This had become possible because a new household convenience, the icebox, a precursor of the modern refrigerator, had been invented. Making an efficient icebox was not as easy as we might now suppose. In the early 19th century, the knowledge of the physics of heat, which was essential to a science of refrigeration, was rudimentary. The common sense notion that the best icebox was one that prevented the ice from melting was, of course, mistaken, for it was the melting of the ice that performed the cooling. Nevertheless, early efforts to economize ice included wrapping up the ice in blankets, which kept the ice from doing its job. Not until near the end of the 19th century did inventors achieve the delicate balance of insulation and circulation needed for an efficient icebox. But as early as 1803, an ingenious Maryland farmer, Thomas Moore, had been on the right track. He owned a farm about 20 miles outside the city of Washington, for which the village of Georgetown was the market center. When he used an icebox of his own design to transport his butter to market, he found that customers would pass up the rapidly melting stuff in the tubs of his competitors to pay a premium price for his butter, still fresh and hard in neat 1-pound bricks. One advantage of his icebox, Moore explained, was that farmers would no longer have to travel to market at night in order to keep their produce cool.
Passage 2. I'd like to say a few words about the organizational structure of LAMPO. Now, if you look at the chart, you will see that the managing director, that is, Mr. Bruce, is responsible for running the company and is accountable to the board. Now, he is assisted by four executive departments. These are Human Resources, which is responsible for personnel training and management development. Then there's the Finance Department, which takes care of corporate finance and accounting. Next, we have the Management Services Department, led by Peter Collins, who is in charge of rationalization throughout the company. And finally, there is the R&D Department, Research and Development, which works closely with the five regions on new product development. So, this then brings me on to the regions. Directly under the managing director, there are five regional managers. Each of them is responsible for the day-to-day management of a territory. These are geographically split into north, south, east, west, and central regions. Now then, the five regions are supported by two sections, marketing and technical services. They are organized on a matrix basis, with section leaders accountable to the regional managers. They work closely with the regions on the marketing and technical side. Now, in addition to the parent company, Lampel has three subsidiaries, namely Lampel France, Germany, and Japan. The subsidiaries report to the export sales department, which in turn is accountable to the board. Right, well, that's a brief overview. Are there any questions?
Passage 3. Our company is active in world markets, and we employ just over 30,000 people worldwide. We have production facilities, agents, and subsidiaries in all five continents, and we are increasing our share of the world's cosmetics markets. Let's begin by looking at the different activities of the group. This chart shows last year's sales, when we had a turnover of 37.57 billion French francs. If we look more closely, we can see that the largest part of our revenue comes from consumer and salons activities. This market segment accounts for 49% of the total turnover. It includes skincare products, makeup, fragrances, and hair care products, where we are a world leader. Moving on to active cosmetics, this division has dual objectives. Firstly, to develop new, technically advanced cosmetics, and secondly, to enhance our close relationships with pharmacists, a key channel of distribution. It achieved a turnover of 3.7 billion French francs last year. Then we come to Syntholabo, our pharmaceutical subsidiary, which accounts for 16.8% of our total revenues. It regularly invests 20% of its turnover in research and development. In addition to these four major areas of activity, our company also owns Art Curiel, a contemporary art gallery. We hold a major stake in the Marie Claire Publishing Group, and we have increased our stake in Paravision International, a film production and distribution company. Together, these activities account for 1.8% of our turnover, or 0.7 billion francs.
Part 4. Another reason for the worldwide use of the English language is its use throughout the Commonwealth, which includes a quarter of the world's people in one-sixth of the world's land area. All of its 49 member states have at some time been under British rule. In some of them, English is the first language. Others, with several different languages of their own, find English the most convenient means of communication except for small-scale business. Today, the Commonwealth is a loose association of independent sovereign states, nearly all of them members of the United Nations, scattered among the continents and their adjacent islands. British rule still continues in a few groups of islands, all but one of them too small in population to be independent states, but preferring to continue the British connection rather than to attach themselves to any neighbouring states. The transformation of the British Empire into a Commonwealth of Independent Nations began in part in 1867, with the establishment of Canada as a fully self-governing country, still associated with Britain. Australia and New Zealand followed. With all these, full power was transferred, with agreement on both sides, to the representative institutions of people mostly descended from emigrants from Britain, though part of Canada was French. The new Commonwealth began in 1947 when India and Pakistan became fully independent. India's membership of the Commonwealth was not affected by its decision 3 years later to become a republic. All the major colonial territories in Asia, Africa, and the Caribbean had become independent within 20 years. In every case, power was transferred, with the help and agreement of the British government, to ministries responsible to parliaments elected by universal suffrage, but with guarantees of protection for minorities, such as small tribes. One country at first declared itself independent without British agreement. In 1965, Rhodesia had already enjoyed internal self-government for 40 years, but with a regime that in effect gave power to the white minority, who were mainly settlers of British origin. The arrangement was objectionable to other countries in the Commonwealth, and the British insisted that it must be changed. When the leaders of the white-dominated regime unilaterally declared their independence, the British government considered their regime to be illegitimate and joined the United Nations in imposing sanctions, while refusing to use military force. Eventually, the white leaders agreed to an amended system which would give power to a government elected by equal universal suffrage. An election on this basis gave power to black ministers, and the Republic of Zimbabwe was inaugurated in 1980. In many independent countries of the Commonwealth, the British cultural influence survives, and some of their educational systems still reflect this influence. So too with parliamentary and legal processes. Some send military officers to British colleges for training, but British governments of both parties have regularly avoided any interference with their relations with other states, or with their internal politics, although in some cases the original institutions have been fundamentally altered, replaced by military rule, or other forms of more or less arbitrary power. In the United Nations, members of the Commonwealth are quite often opposed to one another.